Want a chance to win £250 in vouchers? All you have to do is fill out the Ballpark's listener survey. It takes just 15 minutes. The Ballpark podcast is celebrating our 10th anniversary in 2026. And after more than 130 episodes covering U.S. politics, we want to hear from you to shape our next decade. So hit the link in the show notes for the survey details and prize draw terms and conditions. Share your thoughts, and you could be £250 better off.
Hello, and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan U.S. Center here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, managing editor of the Phelan U.S. Center's blog on U.S. politics and policy, USAP. Since returning to the White House for a second term in January 2025, Donald Trump has renewed his America First agenda by pursuing a transactional approach to diplomacy and a desire to limit the U.S.'s involvement overseas. This in turn is remolding the global order. And while many commentators have reacted with dismay over Trump's foreign policy, could his more pragmatic approach to global politics have advantages for America and the world? To discuss Donald Trump's America First foreign policy and the U.S.'s place in the changing world order, in October 2025, I spoke to Professor Charles Kupchan, Professor of International Affairs in the School of Foreign Service and Government Department at Georgetown University, and Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. From 2014 to 2017, he served as Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for European Affairs on the National Security Council in the Obama White House. Professor Kupchan was also Director for European Affairs on the National Security Council during the first Clinton administration. I began our conversation by asking Professor Kupchan to outline his research and current work.
My name is Charles Kupchan. I'm a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, which is a U.S.-based think tank with offices in Washington and New York. Also a professor of international affairs at Georgetown, where I've been teaching now for over two decades. I work primarily in the field of security studies, military diplomatic history, questions of international order. I have also had a couple of stints in the U.S. government, both times working in the White House on the National Security Council, once under President Clinton and a second time under President Obama.
Thank you so much for that. So to begin with, could you please give an overview of the developments and shifts in U.S. foreign policy since Donald Trump has returned to the White House in January 2025?
The scope of the changes that have taken place is hard to overstate. And Donald Trump, unlike in his first term when he was surrounded by members of the Republican establishment, is in his second term largely unchecked. And there were some more establishment-oriented Republicans in the White House early on. They've all been cleaned out. And so what we're seeing now is the sort of the real Donald Trump, the Donald Trump that is unadulterated by pushback from what we call the adults in the room. That is to say, those people who hail from the more internationalist centrist wing of the Republican Party. And both abroad and at home, the first 8-9 months of Trump's second term have been disorienting, shocking, I think one could say. The impact, I think, inside the United States is greater than the impact outside the United States. And I don't think that's because Trump isn't attempting to radically alter American foreign policy. He is. And in many respects, he has broken with the tradition of liberal internationalism that emerged during World War II and that continued right through the end of the Cold War and into the 21st century. That paradigm of the United States standing behind defending a liberal rules-based order, that's gone. But Trump, I think, is hemmed in by a difficult world. He said he was going to end the war in Ukraine, hasn't had much success. He said he was going to end the war in the Middle East. As we speak, there's a meeting in Egypt, and maybe he'll have some success. But the world and China and the balance of power in some ways checks Trump. At home, we really are seeing a president who is not just challenging, but in many respects breaching the norms of liberal democracy, of checks and balances that have been in place since the founding era. The courts have begun to push back. Some universities are pushing back. But I do have to say, as someone who lives in Washington, D.C., the degree to which Donald Trump has been able to exercise presidential authority and the number of different kinds of institutions that have more or less buckled is probably too strong a word. But media companies, large corporations, universities, law firms, everybody is in some ways trying to stay out of the limelight. And so there hasn't been the kind of response of civil society that I would have expected, given how determined Trump seems to be to overstep the bounds of presidential authority.
So your lecture, LSE, today is titled "The Promise and Peril of Trump's America First." What is the promise of Trump's policies, and how might they serve the U.S. and its interests?
I think that it's important to stress that Trump is a symptom and not a cause of what appears to be an unrecognizable change in the United States and in global politics. And Trump is in some ways the agent of change that we need. And I think he represents a grassroots movement that we see not just in the United States, but across the democratic world, and in some cases in the non-democratic world, of citizen discontent with the establishment. And by the establishment, I don't mean the liberal and center left. I mean the establishment, center left, center right, but basically those people that have been in power now for decades. And the system has not been working for a lot of Americans. The social contract of the industrial age has been shattered, mainly by automation and the digital revolution, also on some level by free trade. But you have a lot of Americans, particularly Americans with less education, who don't live in major urban areas, who are understandably off. And that's because their standard of living has been in systemic decline for several decades. And I think Trump, in some ways, is a representative of the need for change and the need to challenge orthodoxies that have left many, many workers behind. So that's the promise, that he is someone who's sort of saying, hey, folks, this hasn't been working. We have a lot of voters in our countries that are unhappy economically, that don't like that we have a broken immigration system, that are uncomfortable with what one might call the woke excesses of what Trump calls the radical left. And in some respects, I do think that Democrats, that progressives in the United States did go too far on a woke agenda, and it put them out of step with mainstream. One tagline in the election that when I heard it, this was a campaign ad that ran during the closing months. When I first heard it, I was like, Trump is going to win. What was that ad? It was, Kamala is for they, them. President Trump is for you. And I think in many respects, even if the Democrats have the right policies when it comes to diversity and inclusion, they didn't do themselves a favor by putting some of these issues front and center in ways that alienated Main Street. But bottom line here is Trump is the agent of change that we need. The downside is that he's mainly a demolition man. He's not an architect. He's taking a wrecking ball to the world that America and its allies made, rather than reforming that world. Unfortunately, I think that task is going to fall to his successors.
So from what we've seen of the Trump administration so far, are we likely to see more promise or more peril?
I would say some of both. There are certain aspects of Trump's policies that I like. Trump is less ideological. He understands that you need to talk to adversaries and talk to bad guys. Has he ended the war in Ukraine? No. Is it good that he has been talking to Vladimir Putin? Yes, because if the U.S. and the Russians aren't talking, you're not going to get an end to this war. Is it good that he invited Xi Jinping to his inauguration? Yes. Why? Because we're headed into a world in which China and the United States are going to be the two world's superpowers, and they need to figure out how to get along with each other. And I think that Trump is someone who is transactional. He's ready to make a deal with Putin, with Xi Jinping. That strikes me as the kind of pragmatism that we need. I also think that he is truly committed to ending wars. And he got elected initially in part because many Americans felt that the United States had overreached in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Libya, and Syria. And he is ending what I would call decades of American idealist ambition running aground on geopolitical realities. And so I welcome the fact that Trump is trying to avoid more wars and end the wars that exist. So it's not as if there aren't positive aspects to the presidency, but he's also doing an enormous amount of damage. And as we sit here today, I cannot say with any confidence that American democracy as we know it is not suffering irreparable damage.
Your recent book, Isolationism, A History of America's Efforts to Shield Itself from the World, frames Trump's America First as a correction to an overreach of U.S. foreign policy during the Cold War and its immediate aftermath. Could you talk about this historical evolution of America's engagement with the world and how Trump's policies fit into that wider picture?
Well, a lot of people look at Donald Trump and see him as breaking with American history, the American experience, American values, American grand strategy, and it's almost as if he's from another planet. And if you look at American history from 1941 until today, he is from another planet. If you look at American history from 1789 until today, he's very much in line with most of American history. And most Americans don't know this. Most non-Americans don't know this. And that's because we were all born after World War II. And so we've grown up in a world of liberal internationalism and America out there trying to spread its values and its institutions. But from 1789 until Pearl Harbor, American grand strategy was isolationist, unilateralist, protectionist, and anti-immigrant, particularly if you weren't white and Christian. And a lot of that you see in Donald Trump. In fact, you see all of that in Donald Trump. And if I were to sort of try to say, what's motivating him? What are these impulses? What are these instincts? They're very 19th century. If Trump could have his way, I think he would pull out of Europe and Japan and South Korea and the Middle East tonight and go back to what American presidents did for decade after decade, which is focus on the Western Hemisphere. And so when he talks about annexing Canada and buying Greenland and taking control of the Panama Canal, that's very much in line with the first version of American grand strategy, that is to say, prior to World War II. I think the problem is that the world of the 19th century that Trump yearns for, strategic detachment, commercial connections with everyone, geopolitical connections with no one, that world is gone. We now live in a much more interdependent, globalized world. And that's why I think you see Trump struggling. One minute he's like, we're out of here. He says to Ukraine and to Russia and to Europe, good night and good luck. I wish you well. The next minute he's saying, oh no, we're going to send more weapons and we're going to punish Putin. And I think you see him like struggling with what he would like to do, which is get out and go home, and realizing that we live in a world in which the United States cannot pack up and take its marbles back to North America.
So two major issues Trump's foreign policy has had to deal with are the wars in Ukraine and Gaza. On both matters, how has America First shifted U.S. policy? Has there been any continuity at all with his predecessor's policies?
I would say that the biggest change that we've seen is on Ukraine, where Biden deserves enormous credit for the fact that Ukraine is still standing. Most analysts, myself included, I think most Russians, including Vladimir Putin, gave Ukraine a few weeks. Bottom line is that Ukraine has done a remarkable job of holding its own against a vastly superior, larger aggressor state. But I think that Biden made a mistake in not trying to end a war that needs to end at the negotiating table. And as a consequence, I welcome Trump's effort to end it. But I think he underestimated Putin's ideological commitment to the war and his ideological commitment to pulling Ukraine back into Russia's sphere of influence. And that's why the discussions in Alaska and other U.S.-Russian negotiations have not yet yielded much tangible progress in ending the war. In some ways, I think the Gaza situation hasn't been that different than it was under Biden. And we really don't know what's going on behind closed doors. But my sense is that Trump, and this is part because he's very transactional, has put more pressure on Netanyahu, is saying, okay, it's time to end this in ways that Biden did not. But when it comes to those two big wars, there is much continuity as change in U.S. policy. And that's not because Trump hasn't tried. It's because, as I said before, we now live in a tough world, which is pushing back against the efforts of Trump and everyone else to tame geopolitical conflicts.
So what have been or are the implications for U.S. allies in both Europe and the Middle East and elsewhere because of Trump's foreign policy on these issues? And do you foresee these challenges remaining consistent throughout his term, or might there be a shift as the world reacts to Trump's policymaking?
There's no question that there will be shifts, and that's because Trump is, if nothing else, mercurial. He's changed his policies on tariffs many times. One day he blames Ukraine for the war and throws President Zelensky, the Ukrainian leader, out of the Oval Office, and he's Putin's best friend. The next minute, he's screaming at Putin because Putin keeps bombing Ukraine, and he discovers that he likes Zelensky. Then he goes to the UN and sort of completely out of the blue says, Ukraine's going to win. Let's just give them what they need, and they're going to kick Russia out of eastern Ukraine. And everybody's saying, well, where the hell did that come from? And I think the best way to interpret all of these different statements is not to interpret them. And that's because Trump is very impulsive. And when he says something at the UN, I don't see it as some fundamental change in policy. It's just, it's Trump. And so, yes, there will be change. There will be fluctuation. I do think that for the most part, America's allies are playing Trump correctly. And it isn't pretty to say yes to trade deals that you don't like, to fly to Washington and flatter Trump and tell him he deserves the Nobel Peace Prize is in some respects not standing up to the bully. But I do think it's the right thing to do. And that's because those leaders who have tried to stand up to Trump, Lula in Brazil, Modi in India, probably have regrets. And that's because their relationships with Washington deteriorate. And in some ways, I think what Europe is doing is playing the long game, keeping Trump close, keeping the United States engaged in European security, because the alternative, a rift, a fundamental rupture with the United States, would leave everybody worse off. And Trump is not forever. In fact, I expect to see a swing of the political pendulum back toward the Democrats in the midterms and in the next presidential election. And as a consequence, my message to Europeans and to allies in Asia would be, hang in there, ride this out. This will not last forever.
So what are the domestic dimensions of America First, especially around issues like immigration, democracy? How do they interact with Trump's foreign policies?
I would say that the Trump phenomenon is at its core socioeconomic in nature. And one of the reasons that we are witnessing the hollowing out of the political center in so many different countries on both sides of the Atlantic is that all of our societies are suffering the disruptions of automation, of the digital economy, of the social contract of the industrial era going bust. And understanding the anger of many Americans. And I think it's important to stress their anger is not unjustified. Because a lot of times we say, oh, those Trump supporters, they're just a bunch of losers out there in what we call the flyover states. But the bottom line is that they have been left behind. I grew up in Wisconsin, and when I was a child in Wisconsin, it was a very happy place, a very centrist place. People didn't fight a lot about politics. We talked about cows and cheese and football. And part of the reason that it was a generally happy place is that when I would go around to small towns in Beloit or Racine or Oshkosh, they were all prosperous with family businesses and thriving mainstream streets and factories. And most of these towns are now dead. And what was the largest employer in the United States in the industrial? General Motors. If you worked on a GM production line, you were making roughly $35 an hour on average. The largest employer today in the United States is Walmart. You're lucky if you're making half that and probably less. And then prices keep going up. And so there are just a lot of people out there who are understandably angry. And that in many respects is the, I would say, the core, the kernel of this grassroots uprising against the political establishment that we see Trump capitalize on. But it's important, again, to stress, this is not just Trump. If you looked at here in Europe, what are the three top parties right now in Britain, France, and Germany? Reform UK, National Rally, and AFD, basically MAGA parties. And so this is a phenomenon that is sweeping the industrialized democracies, or I guess I should say the deindustrialized democracies. And then you add to that a lot of the issues of identity politics, the culture wars, fights over immigration, fights over the woke issues that I was referring to earlier, and you really get a kind of toxic mix. And I think it's that kind of, we need to take back the country, we need to restore sovereignty, that is animating Trump's desire to pull up the drawbridge, to stay away from pacts. He's again withdrawn from the Paris Climate Agreement. He's again withdrawn from the World Health Organization. This is in some ways about saying to his voter base, I hear you, and we're going to take back the country and reestablish sovereignty and close the borders and take America back to the good old days.
From the standpoint of globalization, how effective have Trump's policies to level the playing field for the U.S. and the workers that have been characterized as left behind been so far?
I would say that the biggest failure of Trump's policies after his threats to American democracy is his economic policy and his tariffs in particular. And that's because Trump believes that he's going to put up these tariffs on everybody and companies are going to come back to the United States and everybody's going to be building widgets in the United States rather than building them in China. And it's not going to work. And in fact, it's going to backfire. And that's because his voter base that is out there in Alabama or Ohio or whatever part of the heartland you want to refer to, they're not going back to the production line. Yes, there will be some companies that reopen. Yes, there will be new investments, particularly in important sectors like semiconductors and electric batteries, but they will employ a small share of the American workforce. 80 to 85% of the American workforce is already in the service sector. They're not going back to the production line, and that's simply because of automation. And so what I see likely to happen here is his voter base gets more and more upset because they're not seeing their wages going up. They're not getting their job on the production line back up, but they're going to Walmart and everything costs 20% more because of the tariffs. So that, I think, is a toxic mix. And it's one of the reasons that I would bet that the political pendulum will be swinging back away from Trump and America First.
A question for you. Have you filled out the ballpark survey yet? It's just 15 minutes, helps us get ready for our 10th anniversary, and if you're lucky, you might win 250 pounds in vouchers.
Your 2012 book, No One's World, The West, The Rising Rest, and the Coming Global Turn, argued that the American era is coming to an end and that American foreign policy will need to adapt to the new international stage. How effective has Trump's foreign policy been in accommodating those new realities, or is there an increasing sense of isolationism within it?
I think that, as I said at the beginning of our conversation, Chris, Trump in some ways gets it and is the agent that is bringing down that old order. Or let me put it differently. That old order is unraveling. And it's unraveling because of global changes. And I think Trump, rather than trying to prevent that from happening and stop history, which is in some ways what I think the Biden administration was doing. I think the Biden administration was a restoration presidency. We're going to go back and reinstate the liberals' rules-based order. We're going to universalize it. We're not going to let China have semiconductors. And if they can't generate and deploy AI, then they're never going to catch up with us. Basically, they were just putting their foot on the brake and saying, we're going to stay number one forever. And I think Trump, in some ways, is much more pragmatic. this world that we are headed toward is going to be multipolar. I hope that the liberal order survives, but it's not going to include China and Russia and much of the global South. And so I think in some ways that this recognition that sort of Pax Americana is coming to an end is important. But we have to start having a conversation about, okay, well, then where do we go from here? And Trump isn't really joining that conversation. He's basically presiding over the unraveling of the old order, finalizing the unraveling of the old order, and probably will leave us all standing in the rubble.
So with that in mind, how do you foresee the next few years of the Trump administration playing out for U.S. foreign policy and its place in the changing world order?
Well, I think that we're going to see more of same. These impulses and instincts are here to stay. I think that one of Trump's strengths is that he isn't terribly ideological. His base is ideological. The people around him are ideological. Stephen Miller, J.D. Vance, Russell Vogt. But Trump himself, I think, just wants to be a success. And so I think you will see the continuation of a very transactional president and a president who tries to strike bargains. And I would say that if I wish him well on two particular fronts, they would be number one, to end the war in Ukraine. And that's going to take more pressure from Trump. I think he's going to have to turn up the heat on Putin, make it clear to Putin that he's prepared to give Ukraine what it needs to defend itself. Because only when Putin realizes that he's not going to get much further will he call it quits. I think Trump should and will head in that direction. And then the other is that at this point, it's, I would say, anybody's guess. But I do hope that he can fashion some kind of trade deal with China that helps lower the temperature, that helps push the U.S.-China relationship in a more positive direction. Because it's really been on a very downward trajectory for several years. And, you know, we live in a world in which many of the problems that we collectively face, whether it's climate change or nuclear proliferation or supply chain security or global health, it will require big countries to work together. And over the last few years, the level of animosity toward China in the United States and the level of animosity towards the United States and China has been frightful. And so my wish here is that Trump's transactionalism pays off and that he's able to cut, number one, a trade deal with China that then opens the door to a de-escalation in the broader relationship.
Thank you. Well, I think that's a good place for us to finish. But before we do finish, I'd like to give you the opportunity to direct our listeners' attention to any recent or upcoming books, articles, or other projects you're working on that you think they might find to be of interest.
Well, Chris, you were kind enough to mention already my last book on isolationism. It's really a history of American isolationism from the founding era through until Trump. And I do think it helps readers understand Trump and the interconnections between where we are today and where we came from. My next book, which will be coming out next year, is called Bringing Order to Anarchy, Governing the World to Come. And it's really a thought piece about picking up where Trump leaves off. That is to say, okay, this order is ending. Let's have a conversation about that next order, because it's past time to think about how to govern and how to produce collective initiative in a multipolar world that remains globalized.
Okay, well, our listeners should watch out for that and can also find links to the other resources we've talked about in our show notes. Professor Charles Kupchan, thank you so much for speaking to The Ballpark today.
Been my pleasure to have this conversation with you. Thank you.
Professor Charles Kupchan is Professor of International Affairs in the School of Foreign Service and Government Department at Georgetown University and Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. And that's it for this episode of The Ballpark. Thanks to Professor Charles Kupchan for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan U.S. Center, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/united-states. On X and Instagram, we're @LSE_US, and on LinkedIn, we're @LSE United States. This episode of The Ballpark was produced by Chris Gilson and Avan Fata. A theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and like lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. You can email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at lse_us and tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. It helps other people find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan US Centre or the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.